Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, if I can vote for this bill, there's not many people who shouldn't be able to support it.
Yeah, who would have thought it would be news that Dennis Kucinich was voting for a Democratic health care reform bill? We're staying on health care every day this week here, and Kucinich was one of two members who announced their support yesterday, giving Speaker Pelosi and President Obama a big boost. So we'll talk about the final push for legislation and why there might be a student loan measure attached to health reform. And later today, the Congressional Budget Office is set to officially release, actually, they did just officially release their highly anticipated assessment of the bill. And the early word on that is that the bill would cut the deficit by $1.3 trillion over 20 years, more than either the original House or the original Senate bill. And this is exactly what Democrats wanted to hear from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which has been tough in the past. Ezra Klein, columnist at The Washington Post and Newsweek, joins me now. He's been following this as closely as anyone. Hi, Ezra. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
So everyone's been waiting for these CBO numbers. And in fact, President Obama, I don't even know if you've heard this yet, just had a reaction. He says the health care bill will be the most significant effort to reduce deficits since the balanced budget law. What's the bottom line?
That bottom line is certainly true. The CBO report that just came back was very good for Democrats because it showed two things. One is that the bill is better on coverage than the Senate bill. That's very important for the House. The bill covers 32 million people. It'll be about 95% of legal American residents will have health care coverage. And the second thing was that it does better on cost control than either the House or the Senate bill, which is very good for conservative Democrats in the House. And the reasons there are twofold. One is the excise tax, which you've probably heard of. They made it
That's what they call the Cadillac Health Plans tax,
exactly.
Right?
They made a very technical change to it, which it's important to explain, but it may take a second here. The way that used to work was that it was on health care plans above, if I remember correctly, $25,000 or $24,000. And then every year, because, you know, everything gets more expensive every year, that went up by inflation plus 1%. So if inflation was 3%, it would be 4%, a 4% higher threshold the next year. They took away that plus 1%. So now it just goes up by inflation. And because healthcare plans go up by much faster than inflation, that means that tax will hit more people in the second decade than before. That's part of why you're seeing much larger savings in the second decade.
So that's how it's going to save a lot more money for the federal government, but that's also why, you know, my 1983 Volvo health plan will someday be counted as a Cadillac health plan.
Well, not necessarily. If you, in fact, do have a 1983 Volvo health plan, then it won't be. The big piece here is that a lot of health care plans don't rise that fast in cost, and a lot of them are, you know, fairly cheap. What this plan wants to do is it wants to make cheaper plans look even better relative to more expensive plans. Right now in health care, we have all employer-based health care tax-free. And the idea here is that if you can take the most expensive plans, which are in some ways driving up healthcare costs in the whole system, and make them look even worse than they are, because we're protected from the cost right now because it's all tax-free, then you can give a competitive advantage to, you know, things like HMOs and managed care that have proven capable of holding down costs. And if you do that, they have an even better reason to try and hold down costs more aggressively than they have in recent years. And if you do that, then maybe the whole system's growth slows down. So it isn't a tax in the sense that the idea is that it will raise money. The idea is that it will actually control costs. And one of the ways you do that is you make not controlling costs a bad economic bet.
Since I think the Congressional Budget Office numbers are going to dominate the news today, let me tell you what I think we're going to hear from Democrats and from Republicans and why it's going to be so confusing to so many Americans who don't follow this as closely as we do. The Republicans will say this bill, according to the Congressional Budget Office, will cost $940 billion over the first 10 years. I think that's the CBO's number. This is going to cost you, the taxpayers, $940 billion over the first 10 years that we wouldn't have otherwise spent. The Democrats are going to say this bill is going to reduce the deficit by $130 billion during the first 10 years. We're going to save you taxpayers $130 billion over the first 10 years. So the question is, how can you spend $940 billion that you wouldn't have spent otherwise and save $130 billion.
So imagine you work at a small business, and imagine all of your computers are really, really old. And so the people in your business, they spend a lot of time waiting for things to load, and they spend a lot of time not being able to use, say, the new Microsoft Excel, which means they can't do spreadsheets they need to do. And so one year you decide, enough. We are going to invest, and we're going to upgrade all of our computers. And then over the next 10 years, because people are more productive, they can do more things in a given day, they do it faster, they have better programs, you actually save money in the overall. That's what we're talking about here. There is a large investment to cover people. And by the way, two-thirds of that money is old money. It isn't new money the government is raising. It's money we're getting from Medicare, money we're getting from other parts of the government. We're changing the way we spend money we currently spend. But a third of that is new money, things like the excise tax. But so you do that, and on the other hand, there are these different cost controls. The excise tax is one, but there are changes to Medicare, and there are other things in there that we expect to be effective. And so over time, the cost controls end up being larger than the investment in them and the investment in coverage. So that is the answer. The question is whether the cost controls can work. But theoretically, any business will tell you that it's certainly possible to invest in something expensive that will save you money in the long run.
And the Republicans will argue that the cost controls won't work because a lot of them are in savings from Medicare that will be politically impossible for members of Congress to actually defund over the coming years, and that's a political argument that I don't want to get bogged down in. But
Let me say one. If you don't mind, I'd like to say one word on that argument.
Sure.
I don't think I agree. We shouldn't get bogged down in it. But for one thing, we've done much larger cuts in Medicare than this bill envisions in the past. If, for instance, in 1997. But the other thing that we should say about it is that if we have now taken the position as a country that Congress is not able to do even modest reductions in spending, and given what we spend in a year, this stuff is very modest. What we're saying is that we as a country will go bankrupt. I call this deficit nihilism. If we're saying that Congress can't in any way be trusted to solve our problems, then our problems simply won't get solved. And the question is, should people have health care in the 30 or 40 years before we go bankrupt? But when Republicans like Representative Paul Ryan come out with plans that are much more ambitious, obviously they can't make that same argument. So we either need to agree to live in a world, or to talk about a world in which Congress can do the things it needs to do, or it can't. But if it can't, then we need to understand we're simply hurtling towards destruction anyway, and we're simply riding out the decline of America and decide how we want to do that.
Jamie in West Milford, you're on WNYC with Washington Post and Newsweek columnist Ezra Klein, following the healthcare endgame. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Brian. The president the other day said that employers would see a 3,000% decrease in their premiums. How is that possible?
That is not possible. I don't know where it's coming from.
but he didn't say that 3,000%, did he, Ezra?
I'm sorry. I've never heard the number. I thought he said somebody said that on the show.
Did you say that the president said insurance? Oh. Jamie, what'd you say again?
The president, in his speech, I believe his last speech was it in Ohio. He said the premiums for employers on their insurance policies would drop 3,000%, and I'm an employer, and I'd like to know how that's possible.
Well, first of all, nothing can drop more than 100% because then it's at zero. So the president must have said something else. But do you know, Ezra, what he might be referring to?
I don't know. As you say, that would be a mathematical impossibility. You know, the one thing that we could say for employers, to just speak about the bill for a second, is that this is going to be real good for small businesses, real small businesses. The exchanges are where they would get to participate in a large market with a lot of other people, so they don't have this very tiny risk pool where if one of your nine employees gets sick, your insurer raises your premiums 25%. That's a real win for them, and there are important tax credits in there for them. Larger businesses, the IBMs, the Washington Posts, this bill is not going to be a huge difference for them. When the CBO looked at what would happen to their premiums, they said they would change. They would go down by between 1% and 3%, if I'm remembering this correctly, or maybe 0% and 3%. So for small businesses, this bill will mean something. For large businesses, it will mean very little because we're pretty much leaving the large employer market alone.
But what about for the consumer? Let's take my 1983 Volvo health plan. My premiums have been going up every year. My copays have been going up every year. My deductibles have been going up every year. I'm getting nickeled and dimed to death on health care. And this is not where where costs are going to go down, according to the Congressional Budget Office. They're just talking about government-run health care, right, that they're going to save money on Medicaid and Medicare with respect to our tax dollars. Does this bill do anything for the whatever percent of us are actually employed and get health care at work? And by the way, I really get it through my union. I don't want to cast aspersions on WNYC. But the people who really have private plans, does it do anything for us?
The people who really have private plans, it depends who you are and what happens to you. So there are a couple ways to answer this question. Directly, what the bill does is not that much for you. When the president says that if you like what you have, you can keep it, what that means is we're not going to touch it. It also means we're not going to make it a lot better. They were afraid of changing what people had because they didn't feel people would trust them to do that. And I think that probably, if you look at us, debate has gone right about that. But number two, what we have now is not what we have later. People get fired. They get into a run of bad luck. They get real sick, and then they can't work anymore. If that happens to you, if you're one of the people who find yourself with a run of bad luck, then this plan does an enormous amount for you. This plan is essentially a bad luck health care plan. The third thing is the long-term...
Well, wait a minute. It's going to make... Oh, bad luck if you're out of work. But it's not going to make my health insurance company fight with me any less if I'm unlucky enough to get really sick and have a lot of complicated needs.
No. What it would do is that it would make it easier for you, particularly in a small business or if you're an individual, to, A, make it illegal for your insurer to do certain things like take away your health care insurance for no reason, which a lot of them do now in a practice called rescission, mm-hmm. or put a lifetime or an annual cap on it.
Right.
But for a big employer, they tend to negotiate those things out. But so if you get into bad luck and you lose your employment or something, you're in a much better shape, much, much, much better shape. But then you have the long-term cost controls, things like, in fact, the excise tax, but also reforms to Medicare and pilot programs to change the way we pay doctors. And if these things work, and, you know, experts think some of them might, if these things work, then healthcare costs will eventually, over time, come down for everyone. The difficult thing is we can't change this system very quickly. Anything we could do very quickly, next 2 or 3 or 5 years, would be blunt and brutal. It would just be the government saying, this is how much doctors get paid, or this is how much consumers can pay, or this is how much we're going to tax. People aren't comfortable with those types of solutions. They've not, generally speaking, been very supportive of a quick move to single payer or a quick move to a free market system. So we sort of are muddling along and trying to figure this out. But muddling along takes a little while. If it works, though, that is the big advantage for people in a large employer like you or like me, that costs in the system will come down for everyone.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to run through a couple of clips from the show from the last few days and get your reactions from members of Congress. Congressman Anthony Weiner was here yesterday, and he says he's in the camp trying to revive the public option.
I think that what should happen is the Senate should put this on a vote, even if it means amending the reconciliation bill we send them, because, you know, it's kind of like, you know, who shot JR? We should find out if the public option, which is popular with the public, saves money, increases choice and competition. If it does wind up dying here on the operating room table, we should at least know that we did everything possible to save it.
Can that ever happen?
I think it's a perfectly fair take. Bernie Sanders has said he will offer a public option amendment in the Senate. Right now, there are only 41 or so senators signed on to the pro-public option letter, but maybe they could get 51. One general point is that this is a comprehensive plan that allows for a lot of incrementalism later. You could bring up a public option proposal or bill next year and the year after that,
but you're saying, and our time is really short, that the current, what we're thinking of now as the final bill, is not really the final bill. If they're still debating public option, then so much is still on the table.
I would be surprised to see the public option return into the bill. There are things left that will be debated. How much this bill will change, though, I would not expect all that much.
And we had Representative Elliot Engel on the program on Friday from the Bronx and Westchester and Rockland. And he was not promising to vote for the bill yet, even though he voted for the first health reform bill, because he's concerned about how it would affect New York and other what he calls do-gooder states, that is, states that have good Medicaid coverage to begin with. Listen.
so-called do-gooder states like New York, which have been generous in terms of providing health care for people that need it through the years, would not be compensated or reimbursed or would have the money coming our way as we move forward. But states like Mississippi, which did not do what they should be doing, would somehow get reimbursed to bring them up to everybody else's level. We don't think that's fair, because as new enrollees come into the program, New York is going to have to shell out a lot more money under the Senate proposals.
And Elliot Engel on the show threatened to vote no unless they fix that in the final version. Did they fix it?
Well, none of us have seen the final version yet. It's coming out a little bit later today. My understanding from a meeting I had with Speaker Pelosi a few days ago was that they were doing a lot on the do-gooder side. But at the end of the day, this will be a bit unfair to do-gooder states for exactly that reason. This is why at some point we need to figure out a national solution, because as everybody gets further apart, it becomes further harder and harder to get everybody signed on to the same bill. But at the end of the day, if you're a do-gooder, you got to be a do-gooder. And that meant, just as New York has done so far, you know, saying getting this done is important.
So, checklist. Is Elliot Engel going to vote yes? Are you following him? Is he bluffing?
I have no idea. I never do whip counts before a bill, because this is the maximum time when people are not telling you what they're actually going to do, because they're trying to maximize their leverage. It's a personal rule of mine. I don't report on whip counts. I don't do any of it, because I just think it confuses people. These folks will have to have their backroom negotiations and their meetings and their deals and get their arms twisted, and then we'll see how they vote.
Will you answer this question? Will Dennis Kucinich, declaring that he's a yes, bring other liberals along who might have thought that the bill was too conservative? He voted no on the first round. Will Congressman Kildee, who was concerned about the abortion provisions, he's going to vote yes. Is that going to bring the STUPAC block along?
I don't think it'll bring the entire STUPAC block along. As for Kucinich and as for Kildee exerting some sort of moral suasion or making it harder for these people to say, I'm not going to vote for it, I mean, it'll be useful for leadership to say, look, if Kucinich can vote for it, why can't you? Or if Kildee can vote for it, why can't you? But at the end of the day, these are cats, and they don't always watch for what the other one is. They aren't always interested in the fact that the other one is being herded easily.
You don't do whip counts. Do you
do
predictions?
No.
Not going to predict when they're going to vote and how it's going to turn out.
Oh, I can tell you, as far as when they're going to vote, what the House leadership has said is that they will vote 72 hours or so after the bill's CBO report and text are available. So that would put the vote on Sunday. I do reporting and I do analysis. I don't do predictions or whip counting, because I just don't think we can be sure enough about it.
Sure. By the way, you're obviously a fan of this bill. Mickey Kaus called you gullible in the New York Times Magazine this Sunday. You want to respond?
Not really. People are welcome to read my... Mickey has a personal grudge against me that I've never quite understood, but people are welcome to read my work. It's at www.washingtonpost.com/Ezra Klein or in Newsweek every other week, and they can decide if my analysis is well-founded or not. I think what I do stands on its own weight.
Ezra Klein, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we will devote our last few minutes this morning to your 11th questions. We've been talking about the census in our 10 Questions That Count series. One of the things that we will do through the coming months is discuss some of the 11th questions that you propose. If there was one other question that you think it would be good to ask all Americans, what might it be? Some of you have posted already, and we'll read some of those, but you can call us right now. Suggest an 11th question that all Americans could be asked one day on the census. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for your 11th questions.